you all today after missing you last week. What a week, what a difference a week makes. I hope you all remember to double your donations this week, right? Well, that's between you and God. We're not going to talk about that. I'm doing something a little bit different this week. I've decided, with the help of Bonnie, to put an outline of my sermon notes in your bulletin. So if you got a bulletin, you could look at the outline, and I left some blank spaces for you to fill in. That's how I know you're paying attention. And you get 50 bonus points if you turn it into me complete and correct. And the bonus points mean absolutely nothing. However, feel free to make any comments you want. I just wanted to point you out that this was something new we're doing. Anyway, today we'll be continuing our lessons in the miracles of Jesus. We've approached number 6, which is the healing of a blind man. So let's look at the story so far. It helps if I turn this on. Just pointed at the computer. It's not working. It is on. I think the battery must have died. Alright, Esther, I'm going to point to you, okay? Alright, so we see the story so far that at the end of the last miracle, which was the feeding of the 5,000, Jesus has separated himself, and the disciples go their own way, and they go into the sea, where in the middle of the night, Jesus walks out to them on the water. And so after that, we get to the very, very first I am statement, where Jesus declares, I am the bread of life. Those are not the two, those are two separate events. I really want you guys to know about these I am statements, because after I finish the seventh miracle, then I'm going to talk about the seventh I am statements in John. So like I said, we're going to be spending a lot of time in John coming up. After the first I am statement, there's a lot of back and forth between Jesus, the scribes, the religious leaders, the Pharisees, and he kind of rubs people the wrong way. And you can tell it kind of rubs his disciples the wrong way too, because they go up to him and they say, it is hard to hear some of what Jesus is saying. And I had read as the first verse, if you were paying attention. This is going to come back to play later in my lesson. And Jesus comments that's because it's hard to hear, because some of people don't believe him, or maybe because they lack faith. Go ahead, next slide, Esther. So the story continues on to Jesus' disciples going to the Feast of Booths. At first it appears Jesus is not going to go. Then he decides to go privately, and he does a very public appearance by teaching in the temple. He, again, rubs people the wrong way. Officers are sent to arrest Jesus. But for some reason, that never really connects, at least not at this point in the story. And so people start to talk about Jesus. A lot of people think he's the Christ. Some people think he's a prophet, but though the text doesn't say it, I'm pretty sure there's a lot of people who think he's just crazy. Then we reach one of the most well-known stories in the Bible, which I will not be talking about, but I think it's a good story, and that is the woman caught in adultery. Jesus gives his second I am statement with his I am the light of the world. Next slide. And then we finally get to our story. So there's so much that happens in 3 short chapters. And that's why John said that there's a lot more that happened that he did not write about in his gospel. So finally we get to our story, which covers most of chapter 9, but the actual miracle takes place in the first 7 verses, where Jesus meets a blind man and he asks his disciples about the man's sin. Vice versa. I have that wrong on my slide. I just now realized that. Jesus says it's not his sin, but that God's work might be displayed. So he decides he's going to heal the man by spitting in the ground, making some mud, and rubbing that mud in the man's eyes. And here I am thinking, ew. That just sounds gross. Does anybody want to put mud spit in their eyes? Even if it is coming from Jesus? This is not something I would be, it's Jesus, okay, maybe I'll do it, but I'm not going to like it at all. So he tells him to take this mud, go clean out his eyes in the pool of Siloam, and he's healed. Some people see him saying, wait, wasn't he blind? Isn't this the Sabbath? What's going on? You can't heal a man on the Sabbath. Let's take him to the Pharisees. The Pharisees see him. They're not very happy with what's going on. There's some back and forth about him claiming that this must be a miracle from God. No, it's not from God. Okay, fine, we're done listening to you. Let's ask your parents. No, well, okay, we'll go back to you again. Nope, still not going to listen to you. You can just get out now. And then Jesus goes and finds him, and he says, do you believe? And he says, like we see in almost all the miracles, I believe. And that is pretty much the end of the story. All right, good job. You can all go home now. See you next week. Next slide. No, but I think this is some good stuff here. And the first thing, it all starts with this question, which I call a not-so-innocent question, because if it was coming from almost anybody else, I think it might have malicious intent. But coming from the disciples, I think this is genuine curiosity, and this stems back all the way to that first thing I said about these things are hard to hear, because it is kind of hard to understand, where the question is, Rabbi, who sinned, this man or his parents, that he was born blind? Next slide. And so this is what they know. This is what stems from that question. We see that they have some knowledge of sin. A lot of people speculate that most men their age went through some kind of test, where they studied all of it to about the age of 13 to see how much, we would say Bible knowledge, but it wasn't just Bible knowledge. It would be like religious knowledge they had. And if they passed this test, they might get to study under a famous scholar like Gamaliel, like Paul does. But most people who failed, they would end up taking on their father's profession. And so they know a lot, they must know a lot about what it means. So they understand that there are consequences of sin. And we see throughout all of the Old Testament and New Testament, there are consequences for sin. Illness, lack of glory, stumbling, wickedness, death. And I'm sure you could probably even come up with some that I didn't even list. But we see, okay, the man has an illness. He's blind. So that must be as a result of sin. So who sinned? Did he sin? Is it possible for him to sin before he was even born? Maybe, at least in their mind, because they seem to think it's a possibility by asking Jesus. But very, very likely, they're probably leaning towards the second one. It was a result of his parents' sin. Next slide. So there's basically two choices in their mind. But we really, as Christians, we really don't think this is how God works. Is it possible for a man to sin before he's born? Or maybe is God going to punish him for something he's likely to do? Maybe he's going to be the next Hitler unless he's born blind. Nothing about that seems theologically sound. And even if it was theologically sound, I think we would look at it and say, this just doesn't seem right or fair. I mean, the parents, it's probably more likely that they did something wrong based on our own understanding. And we do see precedent for this, going all the way back to David and Bathsheba. David uses adultery to cover up murder. Murder to cover up adultery. Yes, I'm going to be dyslexic today again. Slow down, calm down, I'll be great. And so as a result, their child dies. And God basically tells him their child is going to die. And David attempts to repent, but it's already too late. And so eventually they do have another kid, and that kid is Solomon, but it was not the kid that David and Bathsheba first had. Go to the next slide. And this is the beginning of the disciples' ministry, their time with Jesus. And this is one of those times when they're going to confront, which all people who've gone into ministry understand that there are tragedies in ministry. It just happens all the time. You cannot get around the fact that there are going to be tragedies in ministry. In fact, we look at our list, our prayer list, and most of those are, most of those views that someone probably considers a tragedy. And so what do we do when we're confronted with those tragedies? They've seen tragedies. They see the blind man. They see the hungry people. They've seen the lame man. They've seen the death of the child, the near death of the child. They've seen the sick. They've seen the lame. They've seen the needy. All of these are tragedies. I chose this picture because all of you know that I've spent time in China, and this was a very, very common sight. And most of the people, like the man in this picture, have one of these qualities. They were often deformed, or blind, or had some physical problem. And they were laying on the street. And what can you do for them? Maybe I can give them a little bit of money. But not very much. So why are they in this situation in the first place? Next slide, Esther. And so when we come to our tragedies, we normally have one or two responses. We are normally that police officer, or we are normally that doctor. And I'm going to talk about these both as separate things. And we're going to kind of talk about how the disciples approach that. And the disciples approach that as the police officer would. So let's look at how a police officer might approach a tragedy in ministry, or even just a tragedy in general. That's their job, right? They deal with tragedies. Their jobs are mostly to keep peace, protect and serve, help people out. They do this by investigating, collecting evidence, assigning blame, if blame is necessary. Blame is not always necessary. They maintain justice. They establish and keep order. We need these people in our lives to keep society functioning. Is that correct? Now, most of us do these things. We function in society for two reasons. One, because we think we should, but two, because we don't want to suffer the consequences. But there are those people that we recognize that just want to do whatever it is they want to do, and those are the people that we maintain mostly have the police for. Or because some people are just jerks. But there's a lot of things that comes into being a police officer. They have all these obligations, and I kind of wish, if you guys don't know a police officer, go and talk to one. They're great pillars in the community. We have, there they are, over there, one right there, who's the chief. You're the chief, right? Okay, so if I say anything today that's wrong, you let me know. You guys operate under integrity, ethics, morals, accountability, honesty. You have to follow the law too. You're not above the law. Are any of those wrong? No. And I'm sure you could probably list a lot more. That's what it means to be a police officer. Next slide. However, what we're seeing is the disciples here in the story, they're not good police officers. They're more like wannabe police officers. Because they want to skip all the facts that lead up to that first question, who's at fault? Because someone must be at fault, right? Right? No, someone doesn't necessarily have to be at fault. So who could, in their mind, someone's at fault. Who's at fault? Must be the man. It must be the parent. Maybe it's even God's fault. Adam certainly tried to blame God. Maybe they can do it too. So they want to assign blame when there may not even be a reason to assign blame. And in this way, they are very much like the untrained police officer. This is why the average citizen makes terrible policemen. That's why we have all this training that goes into training those people. You even have special schools. And even special schools for even higher training. And so when they ask this question, Rabbi, who sinned, this man or his parents, that he was born blind? They are doing it out of ignorance. Next slide. But I don't blame them. Because like them, I am also the wannabe police officer. This is a problem I've talked about the last few times, is I am bound to my concept of what it means to sin, what it means to be a Christian, what it means to understand Jesus, and I try to take that and I try to apply my critical thinking, and I can only come up with the exact same thing that they came up with. Who's at fault? So I run into Philip's problem. There aren't enough resources or knowledge for me to solve this. Or what knowledge I have is not good enough to solve this problem. I never would have come up with Jesus' answer. I only have Jesus' answer because of hindsight. But I never would have come up with that answer on my own. And as Christians, we tend to fall into the same trap, this wannabe, this ignorant policeman, the person who doesn't really have the training of, okay, I see a problem, so there must be a reason for your life being in this mess. Or, oh, you're doing this? Stop doing that. That's why your life is the way it is. Do you guys find that this is how Christians often approach sin? It makes us come across as very, very judgmental. And this may be one of the reasons the world doesn't like us. But you get into even more trouble the farther you go into the story, because next slide, we have the actual police officers in the story. Esther, next slide. Whose job is to uphold the law, the Pharisees. They're the leaders of the country. And they are not wannabe because they actually hold the position, but they are two things. And the first thing is they are ignorant. They don't really know their job at all. So they take the man who the Pharisee, the people took the man to the Pharisees because you see there's a problem. Okay, well, something has to be done about this problem. Let's get the people involved who take care of it. They begin to investigate, and I use this quote in loose terms. But mostly this has to do with the other one, but we're going to talk about this one first. So they start their investigation. Okay, let's get the man in here. Wait, was he really blind? How do I know he wasn't blind? Because I lack faith. I know God can heal miracles, but I don't really believe that on some level. And so, because I see this man who's obviously not blind, he probably was. Maybe he was just faking it. So let's. We don't really believe you. Okay, so now we've got witnesses. We bring in these witnesses who will start to confirm your story. But that story doesn't really line up with our thinking because he was healed on the Sabbath. And we know that God doesn't heal on the Sabbath. Wait, do we know that, or maybe do we just think that? It says that we shouldn't work on the Sabbath. It doesn't necessarily mean God doesn't work on the Sabbath. And so it goes on to this fact about a sinner who can't be on behalf of God because their limited, ignorant understanding of the Scriptures is pointing them that this could not happen on the Sabbath. And so they did not do their due diligence, their good police officer duty, or their good religious duty that they're supposed to be doing. And so they not only move from ignorant policemen to, next slide, Esther, to corrupt policemen. They've got this rigged system, and this rigged system is designed for two purposes. One, to trap Jesus, because we already know that they're trying to get Jesus. Chapter 5 says they're trying to arrest him. Chapter 6 says they're trying to kill him. And the people know that this system is corrupt, because it goes and they're like, okay, we've listened to this man, let's bring in his parents. Oh, well, the Scripture tells us what his parents think, and it says that they told him these things because they feared the Jews, for the Jews had already agreed that if anyone should confess Jesus is to be Christ, that he wants to be put out of the synagogue. So we know that they are corrupt. And corruption breeds dishonesty. Or maybe it means it breeds deceit. Because the parents know the truth. It says that they know the truth, but they're not going to tell them the truth because they know exactly what's going to happen. And this is what happens with corrupt systems, as it just breeds more corruption. And so they investigate, and the man does this very, very, very good job of getting his point across without actually giving them the information that they want to hear. And this makes them mad, and so they finally said, "You're the sinner here, and we're kicking you out." And so they kick him out. And so what we really see is we see this story is we see this terrible example of what it means to do due diligence and follow honesty, integrity, and ethics through almost everybody in the story,
for one.
But this one person does not take the responsibility of the police officer. He takes another responsibility. Next slide. And he takes that as the doctor. Now, both are important. But Jesus chooses in this story to take this role. And he heals the blind man. And he says he heals the blind man because he must. It's not an option for him. He has to do it. I also think he wants to do it. But the story tells he has to do it. And it says so in verse 4. We must work the works of him who sent me while it is day. Night is coming where no one can work. So Jesus even has his own version of the Hippocratic oath. I hope I'm saying that right. Which is basically, do no harm. So Jesus has to do it because he does not want harm to happen. And because there's very, very little time left. But most importantly, as he says, not because the man sinned, but so God will be glorified. Next slide, Esther. So we come. There's so much stuff going on in this story, and the reality is some of these things are hard for us to understand. Does anybody understand these things easily? We don't really, and some of these things rub us the wrong way, and that's the reason they're hard for us to understand. And we add, because of that, we ask questions. Why does God allow suffering into this world? Or why does it seem like the guilty thrive and the innocent perish? I can't answer that question. But if you're looking for an answer, you're going to have to ask someone a lot smarter than me. But I do know that Jesus taught us things that are difficult for us to understand. And when we look at everything Jesus taught us, this is a very, very minor point. This is really just to show us who Jesus is. There are so many things he did, but we get this window, this small glimpse into Jesus' life. Why did John choose to write about the blind man? And I'm sure he could have chose any other miracle that Jesus did. But he chose to write about the blind man. So that God may be glorified. Next slide, Esther. We see that the reality is even bad things can happen to glorify God. And this is probably what kind of... I like this point and I hate it at the exact same time. I feel like God, who's so good, could allow good things to happen and show his glory. But bad things happen too. And I think bad things happen because of sin. This is not one of them. As Jesus is very, very clear, it is not the man's sin. It is not the parent's sin. Sin is not the issue. But so that God can be glorified. This is the message of Job. We see Job as an upright citizen, as someone who God makes a deal with the accuser and says that he has the best faith and I will put that faith to the test. That doesn't really seem fair to Job, does it? No. But God is glorified in that story. Because this is who God is. Our God is someone who works in healing and fixing wrongs and ending sin. He is both in this way the doctor and the police officer. And the only one who not only does these roles correctly all the time, but the one who is the one who is perfect in them. Not just correct, but perfect. So everything happens for a reason. And sometimes that reason is so that God can be glorified. And the best point, and the story ends with something which I think is a little bit of poetic justice. We see that the blind man is the one who actually gets to see. And because he sees, he says, Lord, I believe and worship him. And the ones that are seeing are really blind. Or as Jesus says in 41, if you were blind, you would have no guilt. But now that you say, we see, your guilt remains. Meaning, they are still blind. But Jesus judges them both. Meaning, Jesus will judge both the guilty and the not guilty. I think judgment, we don't really like the word judgment because we think we hear judgment and we think that that sounds bad. But judgment doesn't have to be bad. It's bad because we allow it to be bad. The Pharisees allowed it to be bad. But they could have easily been like the blind man. They chose not to. That's the great thing about Jesus, is he still gives you a choice. Alright, so final thoughts. There is a lot of brokenness in this world. There are a lot of tragedies in ministry. And I would be very, very surprised if you've not met someone like this. When I think it was in middle school, I remember my sister, she brought home this friend, and this friend was blind. And I remember thinking, how does this person get around? How does this person function? Why is this person blind? And I don't know, I was maybe 10 or 11. There's absolutely nothing I could do to help this person. But there's someone who could help that person. There's some person that helps all of us. Now I can do my part in helping that person. But I cannot necessarily comprehend why they are in that situation. But luckily, I don't have to comprehend why they're in that situation. I just have to be able to do my part. And that is, as a Christian, I need to be able to reach out and help them in a way that they can be helped. And I do this because of the same reason that John brought up in our class today. Or as John says in the Gospel, not John, or sorry, Mark brought it up in class today. And as John writes in 1 John, he loved because we love him because he first loved us. And he showed us that love by sending his son to die for us. And that is the greatest gift that he will ever give you. And if I could show you that gift, or if I could show you that love, and you need that right now, we invite you to come as we sing this song.